Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Neuroscientist and clinical psychologist Professor Ian Robertson, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Brendan.
Ian, you're going to give us some advice on habits.
Yeah.
Forming good ones, breaking bad ones. Because I think we tend to think of willpower as the force that gets us to kind of do the right thing and do healthy things and all that. But habits are actually way more powerful, are they?
Yeah, well, willpower is essentially a series of habits that we learn. And we can develop our willpower if we want to. The big obstacle to that is if we believe our willpower is a thing that we either have or don't. And if we believe we don't have it, we'd say, well, I can't change my habits. So that leads to a kind of fatalism. So, but if you understand that willpower is actually just a series of habits that you learn, then you're able to develop your willpower and change your habits.
Yeah, and I suppose, is it that kind of difference as well between the consciously trying to do something with the conscious mind or else training maybe the unconscious or whatever, that you just get into the habit of doing it? Like, I think you used the example of like driving a car.
Yeah. So if you think, if we all think back to when we learned to drive, first of all, my goodness, you had to think about everything and think about moving the wheel, pressing the brake, pressing the clutch, changing the gear, and it just felt like a complete overload. And that's because we were having to do everything consciously under this limited attention that we have. We only have a single attentional channel, and it really can be easily overloaded. And if we depended on that for everything we do in life, we just couldn't cope. So our brains have this way of using that channel to learn, to then habituate and create behaviors that become automatically triggered, that are controlled by different parts of our brain. It kind of delegates what we do consciously first down to different parts of the brain below the cerebral cortex, which then can run off as habits. And
yeah, heads, to the point heads, where, and not suggesting anyone do this or anything, but that situation where you realize I haven't been fully concentrating for the last mile, but I've driven the car.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, particularly if you're worried about something or distracted by something, people can sometimes arrive at their work and realize they've got little memory of the journey.
Okay. So before we get to that sweet spot where we do things almost automatically, we probably have to force a habit a bit first. Are we literally trying to rewire our brain?
We are indeed. I mean, absolutely, literally. When what happens when you're learning something for the first time? So your brain is the prefrontal cortex is having to do all this conscious attention. But once we do that enough times, and it becomes routine, the different parts of the brain called the basal ganglia, which are below the frontal cortex, they run these routines off without us having to think about them. So we can, you know, we can whistle a tune as we cycle our bike, you know, once we've learned it, or we can listen to the radio as we drive our car. And that's because the parts of our brain that control conscious activity are freed up, because the control of the habits have been passed down to other parts of the brain.
So, which would explain on the other side, would it, why bad habits are so hard to break too? Because they're literally hardwired into us, yeah.
Exactly, they're learned, and particularly if anxiety, if strong emotions are linked to these habits, they become extremely difficult to break. And if we want to break these bad habits, particularly could be habits of anxiety, for example, phobias, the way that we can overcome them is nearly impossible to erase the actual new connections that are made in the brain. But what you can do is you can inhibit them with new pathways down from the prefrontal cortex that can dampen down these activities.
Okay, so you're trying to overwrite them more so than
exactly, and they
do say replace a bad habit with a good one. Yeah, what kind of emotions can be associated with habits? Because I suppose we think of them as just behaviours.
Yeah, look, you're not any emotion you can think of can become linked to a habit, and any thought that can go through your mind. Thoughts are a lot of thoughts are habits. In fact, most thoughts are habits, and most emotions are habits. And so if you repeatedly experience anxiety, for example, supposing you experience anxiety maybe for reasons unconnected with going outside, with being out in the street or being in a crowded place. Supposing you're feeling anxiety just about something unconnected with that, you're worried about something. If that happens a few times, then you can being in that situation, being outside or in a crowded place, can become linked to that emotion of anxiety. So that later on, even if you're no longer feeling anxious about the original thing that was making you anxious, it can become by association. Just being in that crowded place or being outside can trigger that emotion of anxiety. That's the associative learning that is underpins all habits.
Okay. So look, we'll come to starting a good habit, but seeing as we're talking now about bad habits, so that say that habitual anxiety, say negative self-talk, which is can be a habit that like we can just automatically go into it. How can you unlearn that or disrupt it?
Yeah, so that's the essence of cognitive behavior therapy. Is most of the emotions we experience are either because of stimuli that have become associated with these emotions, or more commonly, habitual thoughts that we have that make us feel these emotions. So thoughts like "I can't cope," "I'm a failure," "I'm just no use."
Yeah.
These what are called big I thoughts that people can become so habitual that you don't even realize you're thinking these thoughts, and it feels like the emotions are coming out of nowhere. But if you look into your mind, you will see you become a bit of a student of your own thinking, and that this is called decentering, where you kind of watch yourself, say, hold on a minute, what thought was I having just before I had that emotion? Oh, I was thinking, oh, here it goes again, I'm going to fail. And then so answer your question, the first thing is you have to start noticing and becoming aware of the thoughts. You have to try and bring these habitual thoughts into conscious awareness. Only then can you start noticing them. And sometimes for some people, that's enough. Say, oh, I realize I'm thinking that thought. That's what's making me anxious. Is that thought accurate? No, I'm not a failure. Because most of these thoughts, particularly the big I thoughts, as I call them, most of these thoughts are just simply factually wrong. But because you think them so often, they trigger this emotion.
But awareness is basically 9/10 of the law there. That once you actually
and then you have to start. Then you have to start analyzing: is this thought actually true? And is it true? What actually is a more accurate one? So if you take someone who's frightened of flying, for instance, they go onto the plane and they start to have a panic attack because they start to have thoughts like, "I'm going to die. The plane's going to crash." And these thoughts come in, and the more you're anxious, the more these thoughts run, and without even you being aware, you're thinking them. So what you have to do then is you have to say, hold on a minute, how many planes are taking off in the world today? 100,000. How many of them have crashed today? None. What is the chance that I'm going to crash and die today? Actually, it's almost zero. 0.0000001. Therefore, so you do this kind of logical analysis. This is not something you can do in the middle of a panic, but you can gradually learn to control your thoughts, to change the habits and replace them with more accurate thoughts that don't make you anxious.
Okay, but not in the moment. You have to put in that work when you have cool cognition.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so listen. Let's talk about more bread and butter habits. So in terms of somebody who's trying to kind of, you know, get a healthy habit going or whatever. Yeah. You say the first step to forming a new good habit is to set clear goals.
Yeah, you have to. So you have to, supposing I decide, you know, I want to get in the habit of getting up in the morning and doing exercise. You know, I don't want to be a slug lying in bed too long. And you wake up in the morning, you think, oh, it's comfortable here, I'm not getting up. And they say, oh, I just don't have any willpower. And that sabotages you. That's a big thought. So first thing you have to do is, look, I want to get fit. So I want to get out of my bed in the morning and do some exercise. Why do I want to do that? So you have to get clear in your mind. I want to do that because I know I'll feel better. I know I'll be healthier and I know I'll be able to do more things. Maybe I'll be able to eventually run a half marathon or something like that. So you have to get clear in your mind, not only what you want to do, but why you want to do it. And talk yourself through that so that when you wake up the next morning and you say, oh, I can't be bothered, you're more likely to say, hold on a minute, why do I want to? I want to do this because I know I'll feel better later in the day after
the exercise. Yeah, very good.
Yeah, so the why.
Yeah. So, but and then you have then to planning.
Say, well, what is it? Yeah. But then you have to say, what is it I want to do? Okay, my goal is to get fit. But having a big, distant goal like that is no use at all on its own. You need to break that down, and you have to set small intermediate goals. And people who have high willpower are people who have become skilled at setting small goals for themselves that take them towards a larger goal, and they get little reward experiences in their brain for achieving these small intermediate goals, and that's what constitutes willpower.
Okay. All right. Planning then, right? So you have your big goal, you have your tactical goals then of what are the immediate steps to this, right?
Yeah.
I presume then that you want to make it kind of as easy as possible to do the new thing, remove the obstacle, kind of, don't they often say, like, make it easier to do it than not to do it kind of thing?
Exactly. So I go to bed, say, right, I'm getting up tomorrow morning to do my exercise. First of all, you have to know what exercise it is, and you have to know how long you're going to do it. You say, and if you're just starting out, you say, I'm just going to do 5 minutes brisk walking around the block. You know, that just the important thing about goal setting is you have to set goals that are in a sweet spot of not too easy, but not too hard either. So you set yourself some intermediate goal. And then the next thing you do is, before you go to bed, or you say, hold on a minute, I'm going to wake up in the morning and I know I'm going to think, oh, I can't be bothered, it's raining outside, I'm not going to do that. So what you do is you set out the gear you're going to wear, you put out your trousers and your shirt and your shoes, and they're there on the chair waiting for you. What am I going to do when I wake up and say, oh, I can't be bothered getting up? I'm going to remind myself why I'm doing this. I'm going to just lower the barriers of just taking that first step. And I'm going to make it easy by making that first step, that first goal, just a time-limited one. I'm not going to say, oh, I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to go for a walk for just 5 minutes. No longer, no shorter, just 5 minutes.
Is the clothes out on the chair ready as well? Is that a kind of a stimulus kind of response thing as well?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It just means, it's called an affordance. The running clothes or the walking clothes waiting for you in the chair, they activate some of the primitive habits towards getting out of bed, just that in a stimulus response, habitual kind of way. The other thing you can do is something called pre-commitment. Well, the putting out the clothes is a kind of pre-commitment. But the other thing you can do is to tell someone, look,
yeah,
tell your partner, tell your friend, look, I'm getting up tomorrow morning to start. I'm going to start and I'm going to do it at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. And the fact that you've told someone explicitly like that, that also increases the leverage on you and slightly increases the chances that you will do it. And there's good research to show this.
Especially in Ireland where we all have a propensity to shame, that helps.
Exactly.
And come here, is routine good if you're trying to build a habit? Like, is doing it at the same time or the same time a week or whatever, does that help?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we're talking here about stimulus response. Learning. So the stimulus can be inside yourself, thoughts, but also things outside like the clothes and the chair. And the response is the behaviors that become linked to that. And what you want is to build up healthy stimulus response connections in your brain, and that's what constitutes willpower. And so it's easier to build up a stimulus response if the stimulus is always the same. And the response is always the same. So the stimulus includes the time of day.
Yeah, okay.
It includes what you wear. Or if you're doing exercises at home, it includes a particular place where you do the exercise, maybe a particular mat you put on the floor. All of these things are
triggers almost to make you do it.
They are absolutely triggers. That's exactly the right phrase for it.
And Kamir, you also say in the bigger picture, you talked about kind of incentivizing, what do I want to get out of it? But we should also reward ourselves.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. You know, there's something called the winner effect. And it happens in both humans and animals.
Okay.
And it means your chances of the best predictor of success is success. So if you have a success experience, that slightly increases the chances of having a future success experience. And you can create success for yourself in the brain by setting goals, by setting small goals that stretch you a little bit, that are not too easy and not too hard. And these goals have to be very clearly defined so as to build stimulus response. And so what you have to do is then you've set yourself a clear goal. I'm just going to go for 5 minutes exercise tomorrow at 8 o'clock wearing these clothes. And no matter what the weather is outside, I'm going to get out of bed and I'm going to reward myself. I'm going to have my really nice breakfast after I come back, or I'm going to, listen to that music to make me, you do something that actually makes you feel good. And what that's doing is helping you reinforce the success experience in your brain. And little success experiences like that have five effects. They're mini antidepressants. They're mini anti-anxiety drugs. They're mini motivators that make you do stuff. And actually, success experiences actually increase slightly make you mentally sharper because of the chemical effects in the frontal lobes of your brain of success. And finally, they build confidence and make you more persuasive of other people. So they're incredibly powerful.
It sounds like a healthier way of getting those kind of dopamine hits that people get
online.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the dopamine system does come into play there. Absolutely. And the more you create successes for yourself, particularly if you've challenged yourself just a bit. So doing things that are absolutely easy don't give you the dopamine hit, even though they're habitual. But once you do something you're not certain you can do, but you set yourself that goal, maybe I'm going to do a 10 minutes exercise tomorrow, that's more likely to give you these incredibly powerful effects on your brain.
And there's another win and sets you up for the next win.
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
But look, we all know the reality of this is things aren't going to run exactly smoothly and in a linear fashion in creating a habit,
exactly.
Right? So life gets in the way, you stop, you miss it one day, you miss it another day, stuff happens. And we can tend to be a bit all or nothing about things then, can't we?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's when we get back to the big I thoughts. You maybe get a headache and you stay in bed and you don't get up. And there I go again.
I've ruined it all.
I've got no willpower. I can't do it. The big I thoughts. And this is this is a reaction to failure. And the thing is, if failure is a much better teacher than success, you actually need to have a failure in your program. If it's just effortless and you do it, no problem, good on you. But you won't learn to deal with certain new circumstances you can't foresee. So if you say to yourself, okay, I didn't do it this morning. Why was that? Yeah, I had that headache. Maybe, okay, that's fine. The fact that I had a headache this morning doesn't mean I can't do it tomorrow morning. I'm just going to start tomorrow morning again. This says nothing about me. Learning is inevitably, and what we're doing here is learning, of course. Learning is an up and down process. Of course, you'll be going to have a dip. For some days, it'll feel like you're going backwards or you don't do it. And you don't beat yourself up about it. Yeah. You just say, okay, that's fine.
Okay.
I'm going to learn from this. I'm going to start again tomorrow.
Briefly, before we finish up, how long does it take to make or break a habit?
Well, even the simplest habit, Brendan, even it was research done at UCL in London, even a simple habit like the habit of eating a piece of fruit after your lunch, for that to become habitual so you don't have to plan and think about it, it just comes naturally, it's 70 or 80 times you have to do it. And for more complex habits, maybe changing a thinking habit or an emotional habit of a lifetime, that can take many, many more conscious repetitions before you can build a new habit. So you have to be patient. Think how long it took you to learn to drive a car smoothly. Think how long it took you to ride a bike. You need to do hundreds and hundreds of trials.
But you will get there. If you keep at it, you will get there.
Yeah, and you don't get demoralized by the setbacks, which are inevitable.
Professor Ian Robertson, that was absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much. And we'll take a break.